You know, this is a complex industry. Everyone tries really hard to do it well, but with that said, we still have near misses, incidents, and accidents. So everyone's always asking that question, how can we do this better? I think most accidents happen because of a lack of adjustment at critical junctures in the train. You get a little bit of information, things are slightly different. You have the opportunity to adjust and you don't, and then something happens. This is Colin Zacharias, and you are listening to the Avalanche Hour podcast.
You are tuned in to another episode of the Avalanche Hour podcast, your source for great conversations within the snow and avalanche community. I'm your host, Caleb Merrill. The Avalanche Hour podcast is proudly presented by VEASAN Avalanche Control, safety through innovation, with additional sustaining support from Gordini, keep you outside longer, and Open Snow. Visit opensnow.com to get started with a free trial and enter the discount code AVALANCHEPODCAST at checkout to receive 30% off your first year of Open Snow All Access. The goal of this podcast is to create a stronger community through the sharing of stories, knowledge, and news amongst people who have a curious fascination with avalanches. Welcome back to the show. Glad you could make it. Glad you're tuning in. Man, it sure is hard to beat springtime. We get longer days, sometimes even affording us the ability to jam in two or three sports within the same day before an afternoon barbecue. Oh, it's the best. We got a mostly stable snowpack, freely running water in creeks and streams, and then the corn harvest. It's so fun. I'm sure out there making the most of it. While many guiding and forecasting operations have or are about to close their doors for the season, there's still plenty of sliding to be had on snow. While you're probably in a spring diurnal mindset when traveling in the backcountry, be mindful of springtime hazards in the mountains. It could still be wet loose or even wet slab avalanches, lots of weakening cornices, or new snow from often potent springtime storms that could bring about avalanche concerns when they interface with a melt-freeze crust. Don't give up your diligence now when heading out for long spring tours. Make a well-thought-out tour plan, communicate well with your partners, make conservative decisions when things get weird, and come home at the end of the day. I was crushed to hear about the passing of Rob Copalillo last week from a crevasse fall while guiding the Icefall Traverse in British Columbia. Rob was an esteemed mountain guide, well-respected, with a larger-than-life personality, a friend to all. He will be sorely missed, and our hearts go out to his community, his family, and all who are deeply affected right now from this tragedy. There's a GoFundMe set up for Rebecca and his boys. You can find a link to it in our show notes or on our Instagram account. I had the good fortune to be able to sit down with Rob last fall for an interview for this podcast. As you're grieving this deep loss, consider listening back to this episode. I've found it helps. Today's episode features Colin Zacharias. We chat about trends that Colin has seen within the industry during his 40 plus years of involvement. We talk about his work as a consultant and an evaluator of ski guiding operations, some of the good habits of ski guides that are translatable to recreational backcountry skiers, and much more. Tune in as we have a great conversation with Colin Zacharias. Welcome back to the show, Colin. How are you doing today?
Great. It's nice to chat, Caleb. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's good to see you. I mean, I was thinking back to some years ago when we recorded the first interview of the Avalanche Hour podcast over in the Rubies at Ruby 360. And it's changed a bit from then, and hopefully it's gotten a little bit better and our quality's gotten a little bit better. But it's really nice to have you back. It feels a little bit full circle for me. So I appreciate you making the time.
Oh, well, it's my honor. And congratulations on being recognized by the American Avalanche Association and the recognition awards there.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Colin. Thanks. So if you don't know the name Colin Zacharias, maybe you should. Colin's been involved in the snow and avalanche industry for over 40 years in many different realms. He's held and holds various roles within the industry as a guide. He's a ACMG, IFMGA guide. He's a mechanized guide. He's done a lot of heli-ski guiding in Canada and beyond, and has made a big impact on some of the guide training and industry training programs in Canada through the CAA and curriculum development. He was also the former technical director of ARRI and had a big hand in doing some curriculum development at ARRI. Colin, just as I kind of list through these things, I'm struck by how many, you know, 3- and 4-letter acronyms there are here. I mean, the list just goes on. Some of your more recent work has been as an industry consultant. You do a lot of consulting throughout the mechanized guiding industry in Canada and the U.S. And you're also a regular contributor to the Avalanche Review, the CAA Avalanche Journal. Sounds like you're recently working on a new ski guide manual for the ACMG. And I've recently been really enjoying some of your articles at the Powder Cloud website, which we'll talk a bit about that more later in the hour here. But fill in some blanks for me here. What did I miss? What are some highlights from your career?
Well, you know, thanks for the introduction, Caleb. You know, I think when I look back on my development in both the avalanche world and the guiding world, I was really glad to start in skiary avalanche control in a continental snowpack. So it gave me the opportunity to develop an understanding of facets and depth ore, facet crust combinations, and really these kind of insidious, persistent weak layers that are common to, you know, both the Intermountain and the continental snowpacks. So for me, that was a great start. It was a great, because it built an elemental caution. So I do have a lot of fond memories with regard to starting off in avalanche work, avalanche control work. And so even though I've been a guide for, you know, a number of decades, as you mentioned, I've always kept up that sort of avalanche end of things from the point of view of working as a consultant in the avalanche industry, both with industry operations, like the odd job for highways or for industry, like say a power line or something like that. But also just, you know, in the education world, we're working with, you mentioned ARRI, but also the Canadian Avalanche Association with their professional level training programs. Having that opportunity to work with people from all different disciplines, whether it's research, industry, or guiding operations. And so that's one of the great benefits of working in British Columbia in the winter environments, is we do have that kind of relationship. We have great communication and great cooperation between, you know, avalanche operations, whether it's ski area highways or industry, and guiding operations, whether it's ski touring, mechanized, and research. Just sat on a Zoom call on Friday with Pascal Hagley, where he was asking us from the technical committee, Helicat Canada, where do we go from here? You know, he's been doing research for quite a few years, trying to better the job of heli-ski and cat-ski guides, and he's trying to keep that dialogue going, which is fantastic. So, you know, I'm just thrilled to have gone through the industry at the time when I did, from 1980 to present date, and watching it change over the years and just being a part of it.
So let's dive into some of the work you do when you're consulting, and I think we're going to focus more on kind of the mechanized ski guiding side of things for today's topic. So talking about heli skiing and cat skiing in this realm, what are some insights that you've gained from your consulting work? Or maybe to back that up even a little bit more, describe what it looks like when you go to a to a company, a guiding company, and offer some of these services? What sort of things do you look at?
Well, I come at it from a couple of different avenues. One of them is from the point of view of a, you know, trainer. So I will be hired by a mechanized operation, whether it's, or even a ski touring operation, to do their kind of early season or pre-season ski guide training. So it might be a cat ski operation, it might be a heli ski operation. Usually in November, December of each year, I'm involved in both, you know, go to at least one cat ski operation, one heli ski operation. Sometimes it's several. This year it'll be two heli ski operations and one cat operation, plus just giving talks at another heli ski operation. So that training that kind of starts the year off, and also this year, not last few years, I've been working with some highways avalanche control workers and doing their preseason training as well. So the consulting starts with, you know, professional level communication. So what it is we're doing, how can we do this better, whether it's information gathering, applying your information to your decisions, teamwork, how we can work effectively together to improve our decision making, how we process information, how we optimize, how much information is enough, for example, how do we apply the data we collect every day to key decisions, how do we apply a margin of safety with our decision making, where are we more likely to make errors, these kind of things. So the season starts out with these great conversations in the different aspects of our industry and goes from there. And then in the mid-season, I work with both Helicat Canada and Heliski US as a inspector of operations. So we'll visit two or three operations per year. Last year I did two Heliski US operations and two Helicat Canada operations. And what we do is, as part of their membership, their member operations, to become a member of Helicat Canada and to maintain your membership, and the same with Heliski US, you subject your operation to periodic audits. So an inspector comes in from the technical committee, and we will just go through a pretty detailed checklist of basic daily operation practices, check out their workflow, check out their documentation, check out their client risk communication, how they make decisions in the field, et cetera. Their rescue response, you know, everything that would be involved in sort of day-to-day, you know, part of their operating plan. I sit through their meetings, morning and evening meetings, you know, hop in the helicopter, fly into the field and take a look. So that's a part of my kind of mid-season consulting job. And then I also will come in and do accident investigations if requested. Whether it's that could be a ski area, that could be mechanized ski guiding operation, or it could be even a recreation accident. But most of what I've been doing for accident investigations have been in the professional realm. And so, yeah, every year it's different. As a consultant, there's just the full gamut of what I might do. Some operations, they'll ask me to come in and just sit there and observe for a week, and they just want a really detailed look. You know, this is a complex industry. It's everyone tries really hard to do it well, but with that said, we still have near misses, incidents, and accidents. So everyone's always asking that question, how can we do this better? And so sometimes I'll be hired as a consultant to just do an operational review outside of, not, you know, not part of Helicat Canada or Heliski US. It'll just be a private relationship between myself and the operator. And they're just trying to make sure they're at best practices and make sure if there's things that I can recommend them change, or we just enter into a dialogue about what works for another operation might work for them or it might not. So we have just a good information exchange just to improve people's efficiency, safety, teamwork.
Yeah. Wow. When you were 20, would you have imagined yourself doing this at this stage in your career? And to me, it sounds like a dream job, and it's positioned you in a place where you kind of have this really great overview, this 30,000 foot view of what's going on in the industry. So, would you have imagined yourself doing this when you were 20?
No, at 20, I was working at Marmot Basin Ski Resort on the avalanche control program, as I said, in a continental snowpack. And I was just trying to wrap my head around the complexity of ever-changing snow conditions. And, firing a 105 recoilless rifle and an avalancheer and doing hand charges and cornice work and just trying to, I was basically at the very beginning and completely learning every single day was a new day. And so I couldn't have imagined at that point thinking ahead to where I am now, that's for sure. I think I didn't even want to be a ski guide at that point. Like I was happy doing avalanche work, and it was a challenge within itself. And so I was an alpine climber, ice climber, rock climber, mountaineer, but so I think the guiding thing, it just kind of naturally fell into that. But it was for the first 3 or 4 years, certainly I didn't even entertain the idea of being a full-time ski guide.
Mm-hmm. So like I said, you're pretty well positioned to observe some of the trends within the industry. I was curious what you've seen in the last 5 years that has kind of elevated the game for the whole industry. What are some innovations or some techniques that people are using, as much as you can speak to it, that you think are kind of pushing our industry towards a better place?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think it's really changed since, I became a heli ski guy in the 80s, for sure. It's changed to 2024. There's no doubt about it. And it's also changed a lot in other countries like New Zealand and Iceland, that have a well-developed heli ski program. They've had to evolve at a much quicker rate because they've learned from how we do it in Canada and in the US. And I think things that jump out at me when you say that is, naturally there's been improvements of things like our daily workflow, improved forecasting, teamwork, understanding of the human factors that challenge daily decisions, much improved debriefing, sort of day-end debriefing, improved information exchange between operations and between industry sectors. Like, you got to understand, when I started as a heli ski guide, we didn't have the InfoX, which is that information exchange that takes place every day now all over the world. So a lot of US operations use the InfoX, Sweden, Iceland, New Zealand. There's a lot of operations that use it. South America. And it's a great way to share information, especially hazard information, between nearest neighbors. And it's also a good database tool for visualizing and storing your daily weather, snowpack, avalanche observations, that kind of thing. So we didn't have that in 1988, but we did have a interoperational communication, which was just like a VHF radio. So it's called the SCED, Canadian Mountain Holidays, and the CMH SCED radio would come up between all 8 operations, as it was back then, and we would listen to how their day went. They would exchange key information, and everyone got really good at relaying key hazard information very briefly, just in a few minutes. And then if you had any questions, you could ask questions, et cetera. And so I think that internal information exchange that CMH had was kind of the template for, now their nearest neighbor, like say Wigley's beside CMH, or Selkirk Tangiers would be beside CMH, or RK Heli Skiing would be beside CMH. So wouldn't it be great to share information with them as well? So that evolved. It evolved between the heli operators, the CAT operators, and then between the ski areas, their avalanche program, highways operations, ski touring lodges, and now even independent ski guides can contribute and exchange information on the InfoX. So now it's a massive production. And, you know, we didn't have that back then. So I would say, you know, just the hazard and risk communication between operations and also sort of that operation to client risk communication has really improved, like from the waiver right down the pre-trip briefings to the daily hazard briefings, to summarizing how it was out there today. The guys are much better at communicating the hazard and risk to the client than they were in 1980, you know? So I think this kind of collaboration between not just team, you know, the individuals and the team within your operations has now become industry collaboration and industry to client collaboration. So the public has benefited from these industry changes as well. And I would say there's been a huge change in the focus. It's a much improved focus on worker safety, you know, and that includes everything from, you know, in avalanche operations, from the trend to rack systems, like remote avalanche control systems, like GAZX and Wiesen Towers, you know, where you're not required to have your worker in or near the start zone in the middle of a storm during a control mission. So we've definitely seen a reduction in the use of artillery, reduction in use of avalanchers, hand charges. Although we have seen a big increase in the use of heli bombing. And, you know, arguably the worker's not in the start zone, but of course the worker's flying around in potentially hazardous weather conditions. So it's still, there's an element of risk to the worker, but it's really, overall, there's a big increased efficiency with avalanche control and improve focus on worker safety. So we're more effective and we have reduced incidents, I would say, from, you know, 1980 to present date. So I would say that focus on worker safety, and that also goes down to incident debriefing, crisis counseling, and training. Like, you know, the training for the avalanche worker and the guide is much more diverse now than it was 40 years ago. So I would say all of these components, you know, everything just from your daily workflow to your client communication to just the focus on worker safety, those are big industry changes, I would say, that I've seen. And you really see it, like when I spend a lot of time in Iceland, and they're really new to the game of heli skiing compared to Canada, but they just take all the things they think that are good and they've been able to kind of accelerate their progression, where they have a really good standard right now. There's great client care there. There's great focus on client safety. There's great focus on worker safety. There's really good ski quality. There's great programs. And so they've been able to just really benefit from all of the process that have occurred, the slower improvement in Canada over 40 years.
We talk about a lot of learning from other people's mistakes in the mountains, and sometimes that can get a bit sticky in the industry. And I've talked to several people lately that have kind of had the idea that the industry could be more transparent about these accidents. And there's a number of factors that go into why they aren't. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think everyone makes the best effort to get accurate information out as soon as possible. But, you know, you got to recognize that there is pressure from the avalanche centers, from government, from nearest neighbor operations. Everyone wants to know what happened, even if it's a near miss, not a fatal avalanche accident, but if somebody's involved in an avalanche, or some, you know, whether it's if a helicopter has a problem or somebody has a TRIOL accident, knowing what happened helps keep others safer, because if it's a hazard, mountain hazard that you're concerned about that has caused the accident, then the awareness of that is going to help you keep your own guests safe at a neighboring operation. So I think the basics of the incident comes out pretty quickly. It's actually surprising how quickly it comes out. Like, it's on the InfoX, so it goes to the nearest neighbor operations often that same day. It might not make it out to the public that same day, but it makes it, you know, at least the neighbors know that, yeah, there was an accident, approximately what happened. So operations do make the best effort to get the most accurate information out as soon as possible. But you have to recognize that because this is a remote mountain, often accidents happen in stormy weather or conditions. And being one that has flown in to investigate accidents, I can tell you that sometimes it takes several days to get the accurate information. There may not be one person that knows exactly what happened. And what isn't appropriate is if we speculate. It's better to wait a couple of days until you can consolidate all the observations, you can get all the images uploaded, you can look at videos, and then once you get all that information, then you can put out a pretty accurate statement about, you know, this is what happened. It was this type of avalanche. It was this type of avalanche problem. And here are the dimensions. Here are the characteristics of the actual event. Here's how many people were involved. It just doesn't do anyone any good if 3 days later you're backtracking and saying, oh yeah, we were in error. There was only two involved, not three, or you know what I mean? And so I think people, it's just their emotions talking when they say, we want information and we're not getting it. Because honestly, sometimes we may not have all the information to be able to accurately communicate it. As soon as we can, we get the hard numbers out there in terms of what type of avalanche it was and the avalanche characteristics. And then often there's some information that accompanies that. Like, say, for example, what triggered it, if we do know what triggered it, whether it's natural or human triggered, and then how many people are involved. Usually that information all does come out pretty quickly. But I think sometimes people are looking for more than that. They're like, you know, well, why do you think that happened? And sometimes, you know, even by the people involved, it's just speculative. And so you just don't want to pass on speculative information. You want the information to be accurate. And so that's, I think there is in BC, there is quite a bit of transparency. I think the information just doesn't come out as quickly as people would like. And sometimes it does. If it's like blue sky right after the incident, the information comes out the next day and it's quite accurate. So, you know, it depends on the circumstances of the incident.
Yeah. And do you think much has to do with that in the regard of living in such a litigious society these days? Like, I'm sure you've been a subject matter expert on some legal cases involving accidents. And do you think that plays a big role in kind of the information that's being disseminated after something bad happens?
Yeah, because there are lawsuits for sure. But just the knowledge that anything that you write down, any email or anything that you text can be, you know, procured by the claimant, it's not a bad thing. If everyone is cognizant of the requirement for accuracy, they're not going to just spew some speculative thing, you know. They're going to be just consciously documenting. So what they're documenting is accurate.
Yeah, super objective about it.
You have to be clear and you have to be objective. Yeah, to the best of your ability.
Yeah. So as you've said, you've been involved in quite a few accident investigations. What are some themes that you've seen in the mechanized guiding world in terms of what's getting guides in trouble here? Like, are there any themes that you've been able to pull out over the last 10 years or so?
Well, I think there's things that I would expect, you know, like obviously they mostly involve persistent weak layers, persistent slab avalanches are obviously notorious, harder to forecast, and slabs tend to be more destructive than loose snow avalanches. So there's some just generalizations that are obvious. But I think what surprises me is that avalanche accidents can happen to the most experienced guides, you know, even those with 30 plus years of experience. So it's not like they mostly happen to newer people in the operation. And I think the other thing that is interesting is they also happen to operations with a very rigorous and well monitored safety program. So even operations that have, say, for example, like not every mechanized operation has explosive testing. Not every operation has dedicated snow safety guides that fly around in a separate helicopter that are outside, operating outside the ski program. So a lot of operations have spent a lot of money and close introspection and time to make sure they are as safe as they possibly can be. And even those operations have accidents. So I think, you know, there is this, like we talked about, there is this margin of uncertainty that you just never say never. You're just as careful as you can be. And, you know, they accidents occasionally, not often, you know. Many guides get almost through their whole career without seeing a serious accident, or maybe just one happens in their career of 30 or 40 years. So they're not that common considering how many clients are being guided, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 clients being guided every day in Southern British Columbia. They're, you know, you have to understand that many, many days and years go by where an individual guide doesn't have to experience a avalanche fatality, for example, or even a really close near miss where you have to dig somebody up. So the safety programs are working, you know, where it feels like we're getting a little bit safer. And then you get a year like last year where there were a couple of accidents. And, you know, it was a tricky year from the point of view of managing the snowpack. It just goes to show it can happen to those who are the most careful and the most experienced, as well as those who make mistakes and are less careful. So it's just that uncertainty with regards to that type of phenomena, the avalanche phenomena. You know, we ski a lot, over 1 million feet a season, probably. You know, it's run after run after run, wild, uncontrolled mountain terrain. And we're as careful as we can be, and we apply pretty significant safety margins. But every so often, something still goes awry. And often the avalanches, you know, they're not that big. I think it's easy to underestimate how deadly even a small avalanche, 25, 30, 35 centimeters deep, if the fracture line is wide enough and it's on a uniform enough slope and you get pushed into the trees, for example, even a smallish avalanche can be pretty destructive, you know. So you can be skiing a really, what you think is a pretty reasonable piece of terrain, but if a small avalanche pushes you off a cliff or into a creek or against a tree, it can still result in a serious injury or a fatality.
Yeah, I think it can be easy to get kind of lured into underestimating the potential of even small avalanches, and I think that's what you're getting at here. Do you think most of these involvements have a component of, like, the weak layer is known? It's a known weak layer when these avalanches are triggered?
Yeah, I would guess so. I haven't seen the statistic on this, but my experience suggests that most avalanches that will catch and carry a client or a guide It's a known problem. You know, it's something that we're trying to avoid, and it's something we're aware of is there. And so you're already trying to step onto less hazardous terrain, and then something happens and you get caught and carried. So it's, yeah, I would say usually, especially if the near misses and the, you know, the smaller avalanches that don't result in injury, but they're still problematic and they're still scary. Yeah, it's almost always, avalanches are rarely a bolt out of the blue. You know, they're rarely something that comes from above that you don't expect, or, I mean, that can happen, of course, but especially with things like cornice fall or, you know, ice fall or something like that, where it's kind of a, it can be a remote trigger from a very large load. Outside of that kind of circumstance where that's a bit more of an unexpected event, I would say most often we're aware of the risk and we're aware of the hazard, but it's just, you just, for some reason, just can't keep everyone, you know, away from a short little slope that fractures. I mean, you do your best for sure. And it's, even avalanches occur on commonly skied runs that have been skied before with a lot of tracks on them. And sometimes if the weak layer is profound enough, even that kind of thing can fail.
Do you feel like you've ever tried to outsmart the avalanche problem?
Oh yeah, like especially in my earlier days, you know, spending, you know, doing it for decade after decade, you look back and you go, you look at lines that you skied when you're 25 or 30 and you're, it's not even that they're that steep or that overtly hazardous, is that they're just complex. And so you look back and you go, oh my God, why did I take a group down there? Because it's with that added complexity, the shape of the terrain, it's harder to forecast, you know, that variability in the terrain. So we really try to simplify a very complex thing, you know? And so when you're younger, often you don't recognize the nature of the complexity and you extrapolate a lot more than you should, you know, and you might not have as big a margin of safety. So yeah, I would say you get a lot better as you've been doing it decade after decade. You get a lot better at simplifying the problem and trying to reduce the uncertainty as best you can.
So I think there's some really applicable parallels to mechanized ski guiding and recreational backcountry skiing in terms of risk management. What are some actions that you see people can take to recreate like a professional?
Oh, well, you know, I'd say the biggest difference between how your average backcountry skier just chooses to manage the risk and a pro, the biggest difference is in the preparation and planning. Like the pro, we really think, we do a lot of planning about where we're going to go, how we're going to manage the terrain. And we do a very detailed hazard analysis. So we might get information from the public avalanche forecast and we get information from the InfoX, but we still make our own hazard assessment. And then we come up with an operational plan that includes like a terrain narrative where we apply the hazard to the terrain. Okay, where are we more likely to either see avalanches going naturally or being triggered? And what kind of terrain do we want to avoid? And then we use a mindset, which is kind of like a predisposition or attitude, which kind of helps as a decision-making support tool when we're in the field. So if our mindset, for example, is, well, today we're going to take it a little bit easier than yesterday, we're stepping back because we've had additional wind and snow, then when we leave the guides room and we start taking people out into the terrain, that predisposition or that attitude is like, okay, we're going to be more cautious today, we're stepping back. So that means every time you get to that reassess and adjust point in the day, you get to these critical junctures in the terrain, that underlying thought is, let's step back from what we were doing yesterday. Let's take it easier. Let's be more cautious. Let's apply a bigger margin of safety. You know, let's keep a little bit further away from that bigger piece of terrain. And so then the third component is we have a detailed terrain coding system where each of the pieces of terrain have a name and the features have a name, and then we apply a code to that. So this is open for guest skiing today, or this is closed for guest skiing today, and we'll have a color coding system. And so the combination of those three terrain applications, you know, from that terrain narrative to the, you know, this a strategic terrain use mindset to this terrain coding system, is how we in a very detailed fashion apply the hazard to our terrain choices. And we are very specific about where we don't want to go. And so your average recreationalist does not usually go through that detailed trip plan but they could go through, they could pull kind of nuggets out of there. And if every single person, you know, read through the bulletin and kind of took home that key message and turned that into a terrain narrative for the area that they're going to go, so they have a really good idea about where they don't want to go, and they have a mindset that helps support their decision making. So, okay, today we're going to avoid avalanche terrain. We're just going to go check it out. We've got one good day of weather, so we're going to check egresses in and out of the terrain. We're going to gather some information that we can use to apply tomorrow. And so they have this real strategy, train use strategy. And then they definitely code the terrain, say, okay, given the hazard that we have today and how we understand the hazard, we're not going to go there. So they're really clear as a team about where they're not going to go. That would be kind of mimicking that terrain coding system that we use in the mechanized industry. And that would really help people having that as their plan and sticking to that plan when they're in the terrain would help people. I think that would reduce their risk for sure. I think most people, they talk about it as they're skiing in, maybe at the top of the run, maybe they do a couple snowpack tests on the way in, maybe not. But they don't really have that terrain use strategy that really defines, you know, where they think problems are going to be and what terrain they're going to avoid. And I think if they did do that in more detail and better communicated it within their team, there'd be a lot fewer recreational accidents. And I think some people do that, but very few do it in the same kind of robust, detailed manner that guides would do it.
Sure. Yeah, you really helped to introduce and solidify my understanding of the value of using a terrain coded run list, you know, when you were doing some training with us at Ruby Mountain Heli. And, you know, one kind of sticky point for me sometimes is that there can be a lot of opinions in a guide meeting, and, you know, you got to get out the door eventually. You know, I think maybe some resistance of some operations to using a run list, and kind of we're going back to the mechanized ski guiding setting here. But some of the resistance might be just the vast amount of terrain and perhaps several different snow climates within a single tenure. What would you say to an operation that's kind of hesitant to use a run list due to some of those factors?
Yeah, well, I mean, from a mechanized ski guiding operation point of view, I've all heard this before. I've had so many operators say, oh, our terrain is too big, and or we have too many runs, and it would take all day to review the runs. But then I've also seen operations that didn't have a run list that had incidents or accidents and then started using the run list after and are continuing using it today. So I think there's no doubt in the industry that it's the current standard. And I think I just don't buy it if people say their train is too big. If you look at some of the big tenures in British Columbia, like Bella Coola Helisports and Last Frontier, these are gigantic tenures. And there's many operators with enormous tenures that it's just risk communication and discussion of hazards, whether you need to break into small groups and say, okay, this helicopter is going to be using this part of the tenure. You can always, however big those operations, they rarely ski more than 15 runs in a day or 20 runs on a really big blue sky spring day with long hours. So you can always talk about those 15 runs that you expect to ski, and then you can give yourself a margin of a dozen other runs in the area. So it's just a matter of organizing yourself structurally and breaking down your proposed ski zone use to a couple of zones and running through the runs in those zones. And also just focusing the discussion, being efficient with the discussion. Like, you don't have to talk all day about one run. You can just, you know, focus on, like, you apply the hazard to the terrain. Do we ski it or not? Or maybe you might just say, skiers right line only, leave the left lines. Or, you know, avoid the high landing today. We'll take the lower landing. We're going to take a high pickup because the conditions below. Just the clarification of how you plan to use the terrain, what that does is that brings up what we call operational memory, the historical terrain use pattern that has existed for decades in those operations. And that is a great learning tool for newer guides. And it's also a great visualization point. So for the guides who are trying to visualize what the conditions are going to be like on that terrain, once you start talking about the ski line, you can anticipate the risk a little bit better. And also, you anticipate what you expect to see when you get out there. So when you do get out there, and those questions of, hey, is this what we expected or is anything different? That promotes that process of reassessment and adjustment. And I think most accidents happen because of a lack of adjustment at critical junctures in the terrain. You get a little bit of information, things are slightly different. You have the opportunity to adjust and you don't, and then something happens. So the terrain coding system is, I think, really important, but it's a communication tool. You have to be good at communicating. It needs leadership, needs a good lead guide who can facilitate the meeting, facilitate the discussions, stay on point, be efficient, and really talk about what's important, and then move on to the next run. And it shouldn't take really, we know what the hazards, we get so much information about the hazard. We should spend 25% of our meeting on a discussion about the avalanche hazard and 75% of the meeting talking about a discussion of how we're going to use the terrain. And that's what separates the really good experienced operations from the less experienced ones, and builds good teamwork too. So I just don't buy the argument that the terrain's too big for a terrain coding method. It's just all about how you apply it. And it can be as simple as designating an indicator run, or, you know, whether you're ski touring or heli skiing or cat skiing, you can be, when you get into this new ski zone, what are the two runs that you use to see how different it is since the last time you were there? Something, a fairly safe run that you can ski in almost any condition that you use to enter the ski zone. And then you go through a process of reassessment. Are we on track? Is anything different than what we expected? Okay, where do we go from here? And then you close terrain that you don't want to ski. So the terrain coding can really be just, it doesn't have to be too complicated. It can be as simple as just closing key runs because of hazard. And you can close them for non-avalanche related hazards too, like slide for life or rockfall hazard in the spring or ice fall or cornice fall. So you have avalanche hazard and then you have, non-avalanche. They can be closed for non-avalanche related mountain hazards too.
I appreciate your thoughts on that, Colin. If listeners haven't checked out the Powder Cloud website, they should. It's a great website that hosts some really digestible articles from some of our industry's leaders. You've been contributing in the last few years to the Powder Cloud. And one article that you wrote, it was a pretty simple article, but it really kind of struck me, and I was hoping we could talk about it a little bit. You wrote about the lure of tracks on a slope and how that sort of affects how you see that terrain. And I think it happens to all of us, either consciously or unconsciously. Like, we start to see that terrain a little bit differently if there's a set of three tracks on it, and maybe we're more likely to ski that, thinking that it's more stable than it might be. Talk to me a little bit more about that, Colin.
Yeah, I wanted to write that article, The Seduction of Tracks, because I think everyone talks about the human factor, and human factors that affect our ability to just make an objective assessment of what it's like out there. And what we see is there's just a lot of people, when they're starting out, they just go to an area they're not that familiar with. So if they're a little bit uncertain, they just follow the existing track that's there. And they just get into this habit of, if you see tracks on a run, that it's, probably good to go. And, for somebody like myself that's been in the industry a long time, I've had an avalanche with my group where I was looking down a run. It was covered in, three groups had skied the run. And so it wasn't that wide a start zone. It was fairly small, fairly confined terrain. And it had, 36 tracks on it. And so it's basically tracked wall to wall. And I was thinking, well, I'll just ski down this track slope. And then once I get lower in the bowl, I could spread out and find some nice untracked snow down lower. And the eighth skier in my group, so a number, myself plus a number of people, we just skied right through the tracks right off the ridge to start the run. And the eighth person in my group, so think of how many skiers skied that slope, triggered 100 meter wide, meter deep crown, like size 2.5, caught four of my group. And, so what I learned from that is, and when we did a fractional line profile afterwards, there was some surface sore. And of course, we knew there was surface sore in the area, but we thought this was quite wind affected, that part of the start zone. And we thought the surface sore would be lying down, which it was partly lying down, and it had been somewhat wind affected, but not enough to completely strengthen the layer. So, I learned more something about surface sore, and also learned something about how tracks affect your perception on the terrain. And so what I've tried to do is, after that, as a young guide, I thought, okay, well, this was a long time ago. That would have been in the 90s when that happened. And so I thought after that, okay, I'm going to try to visualize the mountain with no tracks. So if I'm ski touring, there's no up track, there's no down tracks. But it's virtually impossible. It's hard to do. It's hard to separate yourself from where people go, how they use the terrain, and where they skied. And so I just wanted to kind of create that story just to inspire people to think independently of the tracks that are already laid in the terrain and think for themselves and just try to have a fresh perspective on the terrain.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I'll drop a link in the show notes to that and some of the other great articles that you've written for the Powder Cloud. We've got a couple listener questions here. One's from Lynn Wolf. She wants to know, what's your secret for staying strong and engaged all these years?
I remember when I was first starting out as a heli ski guide, so I would have been in my 20s, and I saw this guy who's like super old. He was like 35 or something. And I thought, you know, I'm 63 now, so obviously I'm being facetious. But he was old to me at the time. And I'm thinking, man, this guy, he just loves this. He just gets up every day. And so I said, Guy, what? His name was Guy Clarkson. And I said, what keeps you motivated? You know, like I said, how do you, you're so enthused. You love this job. You've been doing it 15 years. How is it you're still, you know, psyched? And he goes, Colin, I wake up in the morning and I never think, oh my God, I got to go to work. I wake up and I think, okay, how am I going to do this job well? And he goes, that keeps me motivated. And he said, you know, and then last year I was talking, a year before last, I was talking to Dan Griffith. He's a couple of years older than me, and he was still leading groups in CMH, and he was, I think, 70 at the time. And I said, Dan, you're still doing it. Like, what the hell? And he goes, Colin, what's not to love? He goes, I get to go first. I get to ski great snow. He said, why should I stop? And so I think, you know, the one thing is, the bottom line is, skiing is fun. And the avalanche phenomena and the risks and hazards involved are really interesting and keep you motivated and keep you focused. So I still feel like I have tons to learn after 4 decades of doing it. So I think that's what keeps me going.
We got another question from Zach Snavely. This one's kind of interesting. He said he saw a video of you describing how to build a rescue sled with wine corks.
That's funny, yeah.
I want to hear more about that.
Well, what we're looking at is, you know, the things that recreationalists don't bring with them in the backcountry, they don't always bring a communication device that you can just get out at any point in time. And now with these satellite texting devices like InReach or Azolio, you need to be able to call for help no matter where you are. And so that's kind of solved. But in terms of, you also really need to be able to, if something happens, like somebody blows a knee out or they get injured, you need to be able to self-evacuate, you know, excavate people out of the snow after an avalanche, or they hit a tree and break their leg, to kind of evacuate them out of the backcountry, or at least to a place where a helicopter can come and pick them up. And very few people, so a really simple tool is just to carry like an ultralight inflatable pad, like a Therm-a-Rest, like a Neo Air or something like that. Or if you can't afford that, you just cut up a Z foam thing into the shape of a torso. You need something to get them up off the snow, and you need something to be able to drag them out of the backcountry. And so, you know, a simple tarp, like just like an MSR tarp or something like that, and a really solid foam mattress can make a pretty effective sled. And especially in deep, soft snow, you can drag them out quite a long ways with not that much effort. But it's hard to attach ropes to the tarp. And so what I figured out was just 6 little wine corks. You just put them on the inside of the tarp and take your cordelette and put a clove hitch through each one. Put 3 on each side, wrap the person up in a tarp, and then attach your ruche block cord to snug the tarp around the, you know, body of the injured party. And then use your cord lights and drag them out. And those little wine corks, not only do they make clove hitch, they make a great tarp attachment point. But if you have to bivouac, you can turn that into a little snow shelter pretty easily. You can just attach it with the same cordelettes that you have for your evacuation sled, stretch the tarp out, and then throw a little bit of snow on there for insulation, and you've got a shelter that can make all the difference in the world. So we're just trying to inspire people to, you don't have to spend the money and get a professional evacuation sled. You can just improvise with a good solid tarp and a couple of wine corks and some cordelette, and away you go.
So you mean, instead of clove hitching a snowball around a fold in the tarp, which could melt, or putting a stick underneath the tarp and clove hitching around the stick, which might cut through the material, use your cordelette to cinch the fabric around the wine cork, making for secure attachment points to the tarp, and then you can secure and drag the sled down the slope.
Don't forget that insulative layer, though. That Therm-A-Rastor Z-Foam, something like that, is critical to get them up off the snow and protect from hypothermia and shock, you know, reduce the chance they're going to go into shock. So key things.
It's kind of fun to practice this too, right? Like, especially early season before there's too much snow out there to distract you with all that skiing, you know, go out and try to evacuate your friends.
It's true. And importantly, remember, a lot of these avalanche rescue courses that people take, they stop at the point when you get them out of the snow. But don't forget, 90% of the time, somebody caught in an avalanche is injured. And so that's when the epic really, even if you get them quickly and successfully out, because you've been practicing your rescue skills and you've done an absolute bang up job of getting them out of the snow, then your nightmare begins when somebody is lying there with a broken leg and the weather's clouds are down to ground level and your helicopter can't come in to get them. Then what do you do? So you got to think about that part of it too.
Yeah, that's when like probably 75% of the work actually starts. Totally. Colin, can you recount a story or of a personal near miss or accident in the mountains? And you know, we haven't talked about your alpine climbing, guiding, and whatnot. So feel free to lean on that. But, you know, an event that changed the way that you operate in the mountains.
Well, that's a good question. Like how, you know, definitely near misses that I've had in my career, or actually even just being part of a rescue response, like say if it's not my guided group, but we're responding to some other incident that's happened to another party. I mean, those all change the way you look at how you're going to travel, because little things are illustrated. Like I would say, just having to respond to either first aid incidents or avalanche accidents has made my pack heavier. Like, so when I was 28 years old and peak fitness, my pack was lighter than it is now, and I'm 63. So that's counterintuitive, but that's the reality of, okay, now the Therm-A-Rest stays in my pack. Oh, my tarp's a little bit bigger, or I have a thicker, bigger, extra large size down jacket, because if you're just having to keep somebody from sinking into hypothermia and you don't have enough in your pack, that's never going to happen again. Once you go through that once, that is going to change how you operate, and you will never travel, even in spring on warm days, without an XL down puffy in your bag, in your pack. Or you won't ever travel without a Therm-A-Rest in your pack if you've had to drag somebody 8 kilometers out, just you and one other person. So I think there's, it's not one particular incident, but it's a lot of little events which kind of seemed pretty manageable at the time. But in retrospect, I was like, oh, I could have improved that by, you know, doing this or having this extra piece of gear or having a bigger safety margin. So I think, like the very first avalanche I was caught in, I was an alpine climber. I was 16 or 17 years old climbing in the Adamants, and I was a teenager and I had taken an avalanche course. I took a 6-day course with the avalanche forecaster from Alaska named Dave Hamry. When I was 16, I took that with my 15-year-old friend. And so I knew a little bit about avalanches, but we got caught in an avalanche in the summertime climbing, and we were completely unprepared for getting caught in an avalanche because we're alpine climbing. We had boots, climbing pants, ice axe harness. We didn't have shovel, probe, transceiver. We didn't even have a radio. We didn't have like a in-reach. We didn't have anything like that. And we got caught roped up trying to head to this little steep saddle and carried down about 150 meters and stopped just above a large crevasse. And we're all tangled together in the rope. And we were like, oh God, what did we do? And so, you know, the solution, in addition to having avalanche safety equipment, was to just better roof finding. Like, we just took a dumb route. We punched straight for this pass instead. There's a perfectly reasonable alternative way to get to the pass, which is what we did after we dug ourselves out of the avalanche and brushed off the snow. We went further to the right and climbed this nice little gentle ridge up to the col, and then were able to get to the summit of the peak. So it was one of these things where it's kind of route finding was the big error. But that kind of made me think, okay, I have to really learn more about this. So then I took my CA level 1 course. I, you know, started working in avalanche control when I was 20. And, you know, from then on, I just always had this interest in avalanches because my whole goal was to keep myself safe in the backcountry. So that first little avalanche kind of started me on this, I got to know more kind of approach. Like, I was like, I'm dumb. I know nothing. And I got to know something, you know. So it was a good wake-up call. It was a really close call in retrospect. And certainly that definitely changed how I operated, because I focused on knowledge, practice, and diligence after that. So, but then there was many, many close calls over the years, like little ones, you know, that where it would be, I didn't get caught in an avalanche, but I could have, or it was a near miss, or a remote triggered something. And all of those things kind of lead to just better daily practices, you know, in terms of how you approach your day, what constitutes, you learn more about the terrain, more about the snow, more about how to anticipate hazard, how to better manage the risk, how to better use terrain, and how to keep your clients satisfied and happy. I learned a lot about a lot of the little lessons learned included risk communication, like just telling my clients exactly what the deal was, what to expect. And I'm just like, you know, my job is to keep you as safe as possible, but you got to stay close to my track and you got to work with me. It's teamwork here. We're in this together. And, you know, a lot of the improvement over the year has just been that communication with clients, for sure. So, and that came from being not a very good communicator initially, you know, not knowing what to say or not knowing how to approach, you know, risk communication. And so, yeah, I definitely learned through incidents over my lifetime, for sure.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that with us. Appreciate it, Colin. What haven't I asked you that you were hoping I would?
That's a good question. No, I think the important things, you know, as we talked about, what's the payoff for the recreationalist listening to this? You know, like, it's not all just pros that listen to your podcast. And so what's the take-home pay for somebody who's a backcountry skier? Is there anything that we've talked about that they took home as something that they can apply to their daily hazard assessment or risk management? Something that helps them be safer in the backcountry and also enjoy it more, you know, not have that same anxiety from uncertainty, you know, associated with avalanche phenomena. So anything?
Yeah, I think kind of the terrain narrative, the terrain use mindset and terrain coding is a really applicable thing. And like you said, maybe it's not done in exactly the same process as an operational setting, but again, another great, I'll drop it in the show notes, but your article talking about kind of the recreationist mindset that has stemmed from the strategic mindset of Roger Atkins' work. I think that's a really great resource for everybody to read and utilize in the backcountry. Yeah, that was one thing I was thinking of.
Yeah, and that one's part of like there's a series of five articles on terrain, essentially, that they all have little, you know, train tips all the way through from the first one to the last one, which is called tactical team travel. I think they all go through different things that I've learned about how to keep myself safe when selecting terrain and strategies to do so. And I think there's good little gems in there for sure that I've learned from other people and I have a chance to pass on to you guys.
Yeah, awesome. Well, Colin, thanks so much for coming back on the show. I don't get to see you in person very often these days, but you've had a big influence on my career, and I appreciate it. So thank you very much.
Awesome. Well, thanks for the chat. Can't wait to see you the next time. Take care, Caleb.
Thanks, Colin. It's always a pleasure to chat with you, and I always find myself learning something. Well, we are winding down the podcast season, but we aren't done yet. We'll have a few more episodes to release throughout May, such as Wes interviewing Kyle Boys of Australia's Mountain Safety Collective. Don't miss this one, just in time for the start of the Southern Hemisphere's winter. You heard the tracks Broke Bond by Sholin Dub and So Long by Ketza. You can find more tracks to stimulate your creative projects at ketza.uk. Our artwork was created by Mike T. Check out more of his work or get in touch at miket.com. Give us a follow on social media. We are at the Avalanche Hour Podcast. Got feedback, ideas for topics and guests, or just want to get in touch? Drop us a line at theavalanchehourpodcast@gmail.com or find a contact form from our website, theavalanchehour.com. Finally, if you've been enjoying the show, head on over to Spotify or Apple Podcasts and leave us a rating and review. We sure would appreciate it. Thanks in advance. Also, a big old thanks to the folks who have supported our efforts this season. Veasan Avalanche Control, Gordini USA, Open Snow, the IPA Collective, Beacon Guidebooks, Six Point Engineering, Interwest Insurance, Safe Back, and Backcountry Nav. We truly couldn't do it without you. Angela, Edmund, and Michael, thanks for your recent contributions to our efforts. If you want to help sustain this project, you too can find a link to our PayPal from our website. Until next time, stay tuned, stay safe, and keep having fun out there. See ya.